The Ohioanna Book Festival, the fifth annual Ohioanna Book Festival, will be here on Saturday, and it will welcome 10 authors this year. All Sides with Ann Fisher has invited two of the authors to the show today. Carrie Bebris is a native of Toledo. She's a journalist, college English teacher, editor, and author of the popular Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mystery series, inspired by the characters of the same name in the celebrated Jane Austen novel, Pride and Prejudice. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's great to be here.
And also with us is Andrea Chang. She's a Cincinnati native and started out binding books and now writes them for children. Her latest is called Only 1 Year. Thanks for joining us, Andrea.
Thanks so much, Anne. It's nice to be here.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Just want to let you know it's the fifth annual Ohioanna Book Festival we're talking about. It's held at Fort Hays Metropolitan Education Center from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on Saturday. It's free and open to the public and includes readings, panel discussions, book appraisals, children's activities, and a book fair. You can go to the website, ohioannabookfestival.org, if you want to get more information about that. We'll post that link on our website at WOSU/allsides, you can get more information about it there. Carrie Bedris, how do you take on one of the most beloved novelists, and not only the most beloved novelist, but probably two of the most beloved, or certainly one of the most beloved characters in literary history, and turn them into, you know, something different but the same?
Believe it or not, I didn't start out trying to write a Jane Austen sequel. And given the number of Jane Austen sequels in the industry these days, that might be surprising. But I had been writing fantasy novels, decided to turn to mysteries, and the kind of mysteries that I like involved literary figures or some sort of literary connection. And Jane Austen was my favorite novelist, so I wanted to work her in somehow. In choosing to have Elizabeth and Darcy as my protagonists, it's been an interesting journey. I mean, I was able to start with characters that I loved and I was familiar with, but enable them to grow a little more because the series takes place after their marriage. And they make a good team. I was inspired by the Thin Man movies and other, you know, mysteries with couples as the sleuths. And since they live in Regency England, they move in different spheres. And so they can each bring something that the other can't. Mr. Darcy can move in the world of business and politics and law, and Elizabeth finds out all sorts of things, you know, over teacups and scones and things like that. So it's a pleasure to work with Austen's characters.
In your latest book, The Intrigue at Highbury, the sleuths meet up with the Knightleys of Emma fame. And when I got to that second chapter and realized that, I was all in a dither. Is that typical that the characters from different Austen novels interact that way?
Yes. In my first book in the series, Pride and Prescience, that deals exclusively with the world of Pride and Prejudice. It actually opens at Elizabeth and Darcy's wedding, and they become involved in an intrigue involving Caroline Bingley, one of the secondary characters in Pride and Prejudice. In successive books, The Intrigue at Highbury is the fifth novel in the series. In successive books, they meet characters from other Austen novels. In Suspense and Sensibility, they meet the Dashwoods. In North by Northanger, they meet the Tilneys. In The Matters at Mansfield, they meet Henry Crawford and other characters from there. And I've just finished writing the sixth book. It'll be out in October, The Deception at Lyme, where they meet the characters from Persuasion. And it's very challenging to then bring in the heroes and heroines of other Austen novels. Emma is a very popular Austen heroine, and Mr. Knightley is a very popular hero. So all of a sudden you have a lot of stars on the stage who all want a little bit of attention. And trying to balance that can be a challenge.
And I was going to ask you, how did you decide on Mr. and Mrs. Darcy versus Mr. and Mrs. Knightley?
Well, I got that from Pride and Prejudice itself. At the end of Pride and Prejudice, Elizabeth's sister elopes with a ne'er-do-well militia officer. And Elizabeth had predicted that that was going to happen. She had warned her father about it, and he didn't listen. And Darcy was able to find this couple and get them to marry, and just being that man of the world who could move about in society and get things done, you know, he prevented this scandal from happening. And that was before Elizabeth and Darcy got together as a couple. And I thought if they could do that before, you know, after they're married, what couldn't they do?
My guests are Andrea Chang. She is an author from Cincinnati, and also Carrie Bedris, an author native of Toledo. They are here in town for the 5th Annual Ohioana Book Festival this weekend. If you want to get more information, go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you on that. Andrea Chang, your first books were picture books. I was going to say, how did you get started writing for children? But first, let's go back to the whole binding thing. How did you get from, I was fast. Did you go to China to learn binding? Did I read, or did you?
No.
Okay, you have a really interesting past. There's a lot of strands there.
Yeah. I feel very grateful to have all those strands. It's a lot to draw on in my work. But I actually lived in Switzerland, in Lausanne, Switzerland, for a couple of years, and that's where I met a bookbinder, and I apprenticed to a bookbinder, and actually went to a school of bookbinding in the Italian part of Switzerland. So that's where I learned that.
But at the time, did you think about being an author?
You know, I think in the back of my mind, ever since maybe third grade, I've thought of being an author. And I think it was always nagging at me. But for some reason, I felt that I had to do a lot of other things, for which I'm very grateful.
What was the tipping point for you? You started, as I said, you started with picture books.
Yeah, I started writing, I wrote as a child. I wrote stories like many people do. But about, 10 years ago, no, more like 20 years ago, I started submitting stories to publishers. I watched my kids playing, and I wrote about them, and I remembered. I have a very strong memory of my own childhood, and I drew on that a lot and on the stories that I was told by grandparents. And I wrote a lot of stories during that 10-year period, and I submitted them to publishers in New York, sitting in Cincinnati with my three babies, and they were rejected for about 10 years. And the tipping point came when I got a telephone call from an editor in New York just out of the clear blue one afternoon, and she said she wanted to buy my first story, which was Grandfather Counts.
And what was that about?
It's a picture book, and it's about a grandpa who comes from China to visit his Chinese-American family, and he cannot speak English too well, and his granddaughter can't speak Chinese, and so they have a communication problem. And that's really what is the basis of that story.
Your latest book, Only One Year, also deals with Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, my husband is Chinese-American, and so some of my stories deal with his family. Some of them deal with my family. My parents were Hungarian immigrants, so we're both first-generation Americans, my husband and I. And some of them deal with our children being biracial kids in Cincinnati. Some of them just are stories that I heard from other people. Only One Year is based on something that I noticed, a story that I heard from my students. I teach English as a second language at Cincinnati State, mm-hmm. and I have students from all over the world, Africa, Asia, South America, Central America. And often I've talked to students who had sent their children back to the home country to be raised by grandparents for maybe a year or so, and then they would go and retrieve their kids. And I noticed when I told this to Americans, they were really confused, like, what? Somebody sent their baby away? And I felt like, well, wait, there's a misunderstanding here. People are doing what they think is best for their children. And that's where Only One Year came from.
But the great thing about Only One Year is it also comes from the perspective of the other kids who are left at home, who mm-hmm. stay home and miss their little brother.
Right. And then when he comes back, there's another problem, which is that they're not used to him anymore.
And nor is he used to them.
Right. And so there's a lot of conflict when he first comes back. And I think the two girls have trouble adjusting to having this baby brother around who cries all the time, and he doesn't understand what they're doing, and he misses his nai-nai, his grandma. So there's a lot going on. But I think it's a story where you see that there's a lot of different ways to be a family.
That story could have been written for adults in more complex ways. Mm-hmm. It wasn't simplistic. I'm not suggesting it was simplistic, but what about telling that story in a more complex way for older readers?
You know, often people have asked me about writing for older readers, and I do write books for, you know, up to 18-year-olds. Marika, my young adult novel, is read by a lot of high school kids and by some adults. But I can't really explain why. I just really like writing for kids, and I like writing through the eyes of kids. And I think it's maybe just that I have a very, very strong connection with my own childhood, especially ages 6 to 16. And I think my favorite age is like 11, 12-year-olds, or maybe 10, 11, 12. And I can't really explain. I don't think I will ever write for adults.
Have you ever thought about writing for children, Carrie?
Yes, I have, actually. And it's funny because I'll meet people, particularly at my children's schools, and they'll find out I'm an author, and they'll automatically say, oh, you must write children's books. And I think, well, no, they're just because I have children doesn't mean I don't write, you know, books for grown-ups. So it is something I have considered. You know, right now I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and I'm enjoying writing for adults. But I do have a number of teenage readers. I get a lot of emails from young girls, sometimes as young as like 11. They're usually, you know, advanced readers for their age. And they will say that, you know, they found my books, and then that led them to go on to read Jane Austen or vice versa. And I'm always thrilled if I can be the person who introduced them to Jane Austen.
I would imagine just because of the syntax, the lexicon is more accessible. The tone is very familiar and similar, but it's a little bit more accessible language-wise than, say, a straight Jane Austen book would be at the outset.
Exactly. You know, it's I don't want to call it Jane Austen light, but right. I try to capture the spirit of her novels, but I don't try to mimic her voice because she's an original. There's a reason everyone is still reading her over 200 years later, and that's because nobody can duplicate that. So rather than try and miss like a soprano who doesn't quite hit the right note, I try to sing a really good alto and you know, get them in that way.
Well, my guests are Carrie Bebras, a native of Toledo, a journalist, college English teacher, editor, and author of the popular Mr. and Mrs. Darcy mystery series. She is going to be one of the guest authors at the 5th Annual Ohioana Book Festival, celebrating Ohio's authors. Also with us is Andrea Chang. She's a Cincinnati native, started out binding books, and now writes them for children. Her latest is called Only One Year. We'll take your calls and emails when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hear All Sides with Ann Fisher, Fresh Air, On Point, and Talk of the Nation on 89.7 FM. Join us for news all day, every day on 89.7 or streaming at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. 46 degrees in cloudy skies. Clouds for most of the day and a high near 57. Cloudy tonight, a low of 36 degrees. There could be a few areas of frost tomorrow morning and then sunshine in the afternoon at a high of 65. Cloudy skies for Thursday night, a low of 46 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting their annual Center Stage Gala with New Orleans' first family of jazz and blues, the Neville Brothers, Saturday, May 14th at 8 p.m. at the McCoy Center in New Albany. Details and tickets at mccoycenter.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today.
We are talking with two of the authors who will be at the 5th Annual Ohioana Book Festival this weekend. If you want to learn more about that, go to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you, and you can learn more. It is free, I might add. It is on Saturday. So check that out if that's something you want to do. There's activities for children as well. If you want to give us a call and talk with one of our authors, Carrie Bebras. She is a native of Toledo, and also Andrea Chang, she's a Cincinnati native. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Cynthia from Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies. Hi. I was wondering if you had any advice for anyone who is trying to get a children's book published. I actually sent a manuscript to, well, I only did three, mm-hmm. three publishers. And I actually got a rejection letter back from one, which I was excited because I thought at least it meant they looked at it. mm-hmm. I like the style of writing of like Eve Bunting. You know, it's from the child's perspective. And so that's the style I wrote in, and I don't know what a publisher might be looking for, if you have any tips.
Okay. I have a couple of ideas. Since it took me 10 years to get my first book published, I'm always so glad if I can hopefully cut somebody's time down to 5 years or less.
Right.
But one thing is to just be persistent and believe in yourself and not to give up, because I've talked to some people who get one rejection and then they're just done. So there's a few things. I used to read a whole lot of picture books with my kids. I had three kids born close together. Mm-hmm. So I was reading picture books a lot. And every time I read a book that was kind of similar to the kind of things I wanted to write, I would look at who published that book. And then you can look up information about those publishers, and you can look online or you can look in a writer's market book and try to find out all you can about the publishing business. Because I think sometimes people submit things to the wrong places, and then, of course, they're rejected. And I've talked to a lot of editors who have said that about 80% of the manuscripts they receive are things that would not at all suit their list. So people are kind of wasting their time. So if you can do your homework a little bit before you send things out, I think that would help. There are some organizations like SCBWI. I don't know if you've heard of that, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And they have a newsletter. They have a website. So I would join an organization and also try to find a writer's group. I don't know if Carrie has a writer's group, but for children's book writers, there are several of them around, and I'm in a writer's group in Cincinnati. It's very, very helpful just to get some other feedback.
What happens in a writer's group? How does it operate?
And I think different groups operate differently. Ours mm-hmm. is pretty small. We have about 8 people, I think it is, right now. We try to keep it at that size, and we are kind of loose. We don't really have a real firm structure, but we meet once a month at somebody's house, and we just bring one of our stories. Now, if it's a novel, we send it in advance so that people have time to read it. And we're all children's book writers. I think that's important. To if you want to write for children, I don't think it's particularly helpful to be in a group with other kinds of writers. And then we just critique. We're pretty honest. We're nice. We're kind, but we're honest. Just say, you know, what do we think? Because sometimes you simply don't see things in your own work that someone else can help you with.
And how do you find one of these writers' groups?
I would check the local library, but you can also check SCBWI. They have listings of writers' groups.
If I could just jump in here.
Sure.
The Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators has a very active local chapter right here in the Columbus area, Central Ohio. So if you go to their website, which is sbcwi.org, you can click on local, you know, regions and get information about them. I know that they have some critique groups. They have once or twice a year, they have a small, like, one-day conference here. So that's where I would start looking for.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, that's a national, actually international, I think, organization.
Yes.
If you can't get, where do you live again?
Hilliard.
Suburb of Columbus.
Okay. Well, then you're not so far. And I mean, I'm sure that Columbus has a number of writers' groups. I mean, Cincinnati does also. Or check with the public library. I think sometimes librarians know, or bookstore owners.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your help.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Cynthia.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You can call 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for our guests. Carrie Beberis, she's the author of The Intrigue of Highbury. That's the latest installment in a series of books, the Mr. and Mrs. Darcy series of mystery books. And then also Andrea Chang, in her latest book for children, it's called Only One Year. We'll post, by the way, that website, scbwi.org, on our website at wosu.org if you want to learn more about that. Andrea, you one article said that you were a reluctant novelist, that even after becoming a published author, you didn't have the confidence to write a novel. Mm-hmm. How did you overcome those doubts?
Well, I think with the help of my writer's group, and I think one reason I was a reluctant novelist is because I was sitting at home with three little kids and a full-time job, and I didn't have a lot of time, as you can imagine. And so I thought, oh, a picture book would be easier because it's shorter. Now I know that picture books are not easier, and shorter is harder often than making something longer.
Less is more.
Yeah. And it's really hard. Picture book is just a genre of its own that's really quite, takes a lot of experience.
Are you an artist?
That's interesting that you ask that, because I do have one book, actually, the Choose to Read Ohio title called Where the Steps Were, that was selected last year, is the first book that I illustrated. And I have another one coming out next year that I also illustrated about somebody named Dave the Potter, who's a slave who was an amazing potter. And I heard about him first on NPR. And that took off from there. So I've been working on illustrating now more. But again, I think the reason I was reluctant is because I didn't have confidence that I could do it. And what gave me more confidence, I think, is partly my writer's group and partly just sort of determination and getting feedback.
Kiri, what about you? What gave you the confidence to even put pen to paper in the first place?
Well, I decided when I was 10 that I wanted to be a novelist. I was the kid in class who would take my spelling words every week, and you had to write a sentence for each one of them, and mine would be a story. And one day, my spelling teacher said, "That was really neat. You should be a writer." And I have no other good memories of that particular teacher whatsoever, but that really shows you the power of words, because it was the first moment that I realized that was something that I could do, that writers weren't just these people who live, you know, on, you know, great mountains somewhere, you know, that you don't interact with, that they're real people and it's a real profession. And so from that time on, I majored in journalism in college and did other types of writing, and was, you know, working on the great American, you know, novel at nights and on the weekends and on the side. I did join that first novel I ever wrote was actually a historical romance, and I joined the Romance Writers of America. We were talking about the children's groups, but there are also lots of other groups out there for various genres, and they are wonderfully helpful about educating you about the publishing industry, the process of trying to get published, the craft of writing. And so working with other writers, getting their feedback.
I think it's really
invaluable. It's just invaluable.
And it gives you the confidence. I had a similar experience to Kiri. When I was in sixth grade, I had a teacher who had us do what she called a 10-minute assignment every day. And she had a picture on the board when you walked into the room and you had to write for 10 minutes. And I would just scribble down these stories. I couldn't wait to get to school every day. And she wrote things on my paper like, you have a gift for writing, and or your words flow together, or why don't you take it home and finish it? And that's when I decided, hey, I would fall asleep every night thinking about those stories or what picture would be there the next day. And I still often fall asleep thinking about stories.
And things like the picture inspire you.
It was a prompt.
You hear stories. What inspires you now? I know you're obviously inspired by the stories of Jane Austen, the characters that she...
Yes. Whenever I'm starting a new book, because it's a series and I've got continuing characters, I look at where I've left them off and I reread whatever Austen novel I'm going to be working with next, and look for little details that you just read right over, when you're not, you know, thinking in terms of writing. And, you know, I'll say that as much as I loved reading when I was 10, I was a voracious reader. I'm sure all of us in this room were, and most of our listeners. Now that I'm a novelist, I can't read the way I did when I was 10 anymore. Mm-hmm. It's very rare for me to just completely lose myself in a book and not have part of my brain thinking about, wow, that's an interesting way to introduce that character, or, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I think this is foreshadowing here, or whatever. I imagine it's like an architect walking in a room and, you know, looking at the ceiling structure or something. Mm-hmm. So I look for those little details, little things Austen left behind. But I'm also inspired by things around me, conversations you overhear, or just, you know, tiny moments. And whenever something strikes me as interesting, I'll jot it down. I'll throw it in an idea folder. It might be, you know, two words, you know, that'll give me an idea of where to plant a clue or an interesting plot twist or a character trait.
Yeah.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Victor in Alliance, Ohio, welcome to the show. Hi, Victor.
Yes. I'm calling with regards to the two young ladies and their interest in writing their own memoirs. Tell me.
You know what, Victor, you might have to turn down your radio.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, if you turn that down, because there's a delay. There you go. Okay.
Okay.
Did you turn it down?
Yeah.
I think your radio is still up because I can hear it.
Okay. Okay. I'm turning it
all the way.
Okay.
There you go.
Is that good?
Yep.
Okay.
So, what's your question?
The question was, now that these young ladies have written their stories, so to speak, for children, mystery series, mm-hmm. are they considering doing something with memoirs?
Memoirs. Have you ever thought about writing about yourself, Carrie?
Not in book form. Actually, the first thing I ever got professionally published was a story about a family tradition it was a memory of my grandfather, and that was published in a local magazine, and it was very exciting to actually get paid for something that I wrote. And so I do write nonfiction. Some of it is personal essays, but most of it is more journalistic in nature. But it is a genre of personal memoir is a genre that I haven't ruled out. I'm interested in writing lots of different things.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Andrea?
I think that there's a little bit of memoir in everything that I write. And I do think, even if the story has nothing to do with me, the characters in some way are me. Like Marika is a story that I wrote about my mother. And people who have read it said that, well, when your mother was a little girl, she wasn't that spunky. That sounds more like you. So I don't think I'll ever write straight memoir. But I think that there is a lot of my novels and my picture books are based on personal experience, but it's fictionalized to some extent. And I don't think I'll stick to straight memoir, but who knows?
Yeah, to respond to what Andrea said, there's definitely a lot of me in all of my books. In fact, my book that's coming out in October, I was just proofreading The Galleys this past weekend, and it's a chance to kind of reread your own writing from a bit of a distance. And I got to a section where our character was describing his family that he came from, and I realized that there were some real similarities mm-hmm. in what he was saying to the way I feel about my own family. And
but you didn't really notice it until you were proofreading The Galleys.
Exactly. You know, you kind of get that space from it. But and each book, since my novels take a year or more to write, when I look at the books in finished form, I'm always remembering the year that I wrote that and what I was doing and where I was. And so each of them has that resonance for me, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Victor, for that call. How do you know when it's time to let it go? So when you're reading The Galleys, my impulse would be to find personally, you know, to find flaws. There will always be flaws. Everybody needs an editor and want to change it.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that while I was reading those galleys, I was still making some individual word choice changes, which is easier in this electronic age than it used to be. But eventually you just run out of time. You have a deadline and it's due.
It's a business still.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. But I you know, I'm always trying to refine it, trying to make it, you know, just that much better, this little nuance or whatever.
What about you, Andrea?
I don't like to reread my books after they're published, after they're printed.
Me neither, yeah.
I almost never do, because once they're in print, I can't change them. Until that point, if I'm sent galleys or, you know, the copy editor has sent me back some pages, I will always make changes. And I think I could do that endlessly, especially just on the word, you know, just this word or that word, or make it a little shorter or something.
I am sure that both of you have some pretty dog-eared copies of your favorite books laying around, not the least of which would be Jane Austen for you, Carrie. And I was wondering what you think about the whole Kindle, Nook revolution in reading. How much you embrace that? It has to be probably pretty good for you, Carrie.
It is. And the publishing industry itself is still trying to adjust to this technology. But I'm finding a lot of my readers do have Kindles, Nooks, electronic readers. I received one for Christmas. I had been looking at them and was given one as a gift. And I'm finding just for myself, there are things that I like it very much for. I like to use it when I'm exercising or in the car, obviously not driving, but as a passenger in the car, because you can adjust the text size and things like that. But there are also types of things that I don't like to read on it, things with footnotes or just, not.
Well, and I would imagine a lot of anything that involves illustrations, particularly children's books, right, Andrea?
Well, I don't have a Kindle, so I really the only book I've read electronically is part of Winnie the Pooh because somebody had it and showed it to me. And one of my picture books is on an iPhone application, so I looked at that.
Oh, okay.
That was kind of fun. And at first I was kind of resistant. Just because the industry's changing in such a big way, it's just going to have a really big impact. But I'm just curious to see where it goes. My novels are all available for the Kindle reader. I don't know how many people have – I mean, I've seen a few people with The Lace Dowry or Marika on a Kindle.
But the picture books?
I have not seen the picture books in electronic form except for on this iPhone application. But I think it's coming. I think it'll be coming. And, I just have to – I'm just curious to see how it will go and trying to adjust to the changes because I think that they are pretty significant for the whole book industry.
Yeah, I think that it's not signaling the death of books by any means. I think that they are just going to find their own niche just the way, people thought, it would be the end of radio when TV came along and it would be the end of hardcover novels when paperbacks came along. And they each have their own uses and their own time, and their own purposes. And I think particularly for reaching younger readers now, the electronic format is going to, get people that otherwise might not pick up books.
I know this past summer I decided to reread Oliver Twist, and I don't know what hit me to want to reread Oliver Twist, but I did, and I took it out of the library, and when I would read that book at night, it was so heavy, I wished I had a Kindle.
Yeah, the Kindles, they're lighter than the typical paperback or something like that. So.
Exactly, and when I travel, I never know what I'm going to feel like reading, so I always have this, tote bag full of books, and to be able to have them, in a nice, thin, lightweight format is nice.
I want to thank my guests today, authors Carrie Bebras and Andrea Chang. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And Andrea Chang, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ann.
They're both going to be appearing this Saturday, May 7th, at the 5th Annual Ohioana Book Festival, held at Fort Hays Metropolitan Education Center from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public. And there's readings, panel discussions, and children's activities. Check it out. For more information, you can visit the website at ohioannabookfestival.org. You can also go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you for that. When we return, we'll be talking about postpartum depression and a very fun play that will be shown this weekend in Columbus.
The Metropolitan Opera is celebrating James Levine's 40th year conducting the Met with a new book and a documentary that will be shown next month on public television. On the next Fresh Air, James Levine talks about conducting, his life in music, and his back problems, which have led him to step down as musical director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. It's easy to renew your 89.7 NPR News membership. You can visit WOSU.org/renew to make a contribution for another year. Your online renewal means less paperwork for our station, and that means more of your donation supports the programs you enjoy. And while online, don't forget to set your membership to renew automatically. We can charge your credit card once a year or send you a reminder invoice. It's a quick, easy, and efficient way to show your support. Visit WOSU.org/renew for more information.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing companionship, dementia, Alzheimer's, and hospice support. More at 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead. To us, it's personal.
46 degrees in downtown Columbus, a high of 57 degrees today, clouds tonight, and a little chilly, an overnight low of 36 degrees. Sunshine tomorrow, a high of 65. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Mother's Day is on Sunday. Don't forget. And don't forget that it's not always easy to be a mother, especially when you're struggling with depression, when you're isolated, overwhelmed, and feeling guilty on top of everything else about all of those feelings. Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms was founded to address those feelings and meet the needs of women experiencing them. Joining us now to talk about that is Tanya Fullwilder. Tanya is co-founder and executive director of POEM. Welcome to the show, Tanya.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us is Patty O'Brien. She's a mother who sought support from POEM. Welcome to the show, Patty.
Thank you.
The title of the organization is Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Mothers. Why the emphasis on perinatal versus the more familiar postpartum?
Well, perinatal actually versus prenatal means to encompass all of pregnancy and postpartum. And we chose that because what we know is that in the incidence rate for a depression around pregnancy is and postpartum is basically about the same through pregnancy and through that first year postpartum. So just as many mothers deliver dealing with depression or anxiety, then after the baby comes. So bringing in that to make it the whole time period, meaning pregnancy and postpartum.
The statistics on it are pretty surprising, I guess. 1 in 10 women experience some level of depression related to pregnancy one way or the other. Is that just what we know of, what's reported, or could it be much larger?
Well, certainly, because we rely on self-reporting. There's no blood test that says, there it is, that's definitely it. And, of course, there is the shame. So who is reaching out? And who is talking to their doctor or their family and seeking help, and you know, and who's suffering in silence?
Patty O'Brien, you sought support from POEM. What was your experience, and how did you find out about POEM? So how did it all start out for you?
Well, it was after my second pregnancy, and I'd actually experienced postpartum depression and anxiety with my first son as well, but I just was kind of so busy in my life circumstantially and overwhelmed that I didn't really seek much help. I had gone on medication, and I tried counseling and didn't really work out. And I just felt kind of alone, and I didn't really know much about what I was going through. The second time around, I felt even worse than the first time around, and I just knew that I needed something different, and I needed to get through this, and I don't think I'd ever really gotten over the first one. And I found POEM actually through the internet. I was just kind of searching for anything.
Started Googling.
I did, exactly. I was searching for anything I could find about postpartum depression, and really, even a couple years ago, there just wasn't much out there. I mean, I just felt like it was really hard. And one day, I was just at my wit's end. I was desperate, and I found their group, and I called the support line, and they really helped me out.
Did you just work with them through the support line, or what other sorts of services did they offer?
No, I talked to, I believe it was Amy, through the support line, and she informed me about the group meetings that they had, and so I attended some of their support group meetings, and that is really what I felt helped me to move forward.
We're talking about the organization. It's called Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms. The acronym is POEM. It was founded to address feelings of depression and isolation and the guilt that surrounds some of that for new moms sometimes, and meet the needs of women experiencing them. If you have a comment, if you've experienced that and want to share your story with us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides at WOSU.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I've posted some references in the last few days to a production coming up this weekend as a fundraiser for POM. It's called The Momologues, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that, Tanya.
Sure. Well, as you said, this weekend we have this comedy production.
That's right. Coming it's a comedy, up. Folks.
It is. And while the issues that we address, postpartum pregnancy and postpartum depression and anxiety, and the struggles that mothers have, are very serious, all moms should laugh because there are so many funny moments that happen. And so when we saw the clips of the original production in Boston, we knew that this was such a great fit because while a lot of things we talk about in group are very serious and there is a lot of despair, we also laugh. And bringing moms together to laugh, have a good time, take a breath, enjoy, take a little care of themselves, we knew it was a great fit to bring that.
There is a talk. Are you in one of the groups, the talk groups?
I'm not currently, but I was.
What was it like to suddenly be? You think of people only talking about a lot of this stuff with just people they're close with, but actually it's sometimes easier to do it with people you don't know very well?
Exactly. I actually felt like I had found a place where people finally understood what I was going through. And they always talk at the meetings about how it's normal to feel, a little bit down or worse or weird afterwards, maybe after talking about all of that and, you know, getting it out. But I actually, I would feel better. I would feel normal. I would feel like there was finally a place where, someone understood and could give me some answers.
Tanya Fulwilder, you co-founded POM. Was it from personal experience that you thought this was necessary?
Yes.
Tell us about your experience.
Well, 13 years ago, I felt very much like what Patty described, alone, like a failure. And there was a small group at the time, a small support group in Columbus at the time, and that was my lifesaver. It was what helped me move forward and talk to my doctor and wake up every day knowing I could go on and find treatment. And so as I began to volunteer with that small group, we knew we needed to do more. We needed to reach more moms and more healthcare providers that could share that with their patients. So we founded a nonprofit. Why not? To address that in the city and throughout the state.
So how many folks have you served now? Do you have any numbers? You can talk about the women that contact you every year, that sort of thing?
Oh, goodness. Well, we around about 300 families a year is what we average. When we started, we had just a little notebook that I had stolen from my preschooler. So we didn't keep the best records in the beginning. But around 300 families a year that reach out to us. Through the line.
I was going to ask you, and Patty O'Brien, jump in. I can't assume, but let's just suggest that there's a male in your life. There is the dad. Did they share some of the frustration with you that they couldn't help you enough, that they couldn't help you kind of dig out of this, and they felt some of that same kind of guilt, but from another perspective?
Certainly, my husband did. We very much are a team and work as a team, and he felt very frustrated, I know, because he wanted to fix the situation, and he saw me struggling, and he tried to come up with things that he could do, solutions, you know, organize the house better, come up with systems, enlist family members, and he tried all of these things, and some of them were very helpful, but I know that he was frustrated because part of the frustration he felt was that I couldn't really express to him what to do to make it better because I didn't know myself. I didn't really understand what I was going through at first. Sometimes I didn't know where these emotions were coming from or, you know, how to deal with it myself. And I know that he was very frustrated because he wanted to fix it, but he felt like he was helpless, standing by, not knowing what to do.
I've mentioned it on Facebook. I should probably say now that I play a role in Momologues this week, weekend on Friday and Saturday. We'll post a link to the production, and if you want to get tickets and that sort of thing, we'll have that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. I also have it on Facebook and All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. I play the role of a somewhat controlling, I guess, person who sort of chills out by the end, I think, and kind of lets life just happen to her a little bit more. But one of the things about the show, besides the fact that it is a comedy and there are a lot of funny moments, is there's never a point where anyone's directly talking about depression or post-traumatic stress or postpartum depression or anything like that. They never really come out and talk about that, do they?
No. No, that's not directly addressed. And that's certainly something we thought about when we saw the script. But at the same time, we felt like bringing together mothers about what's real. Because in groups, we don't always talk about just the symptoms. But sometimes it's about adjusting your expectations. What is a successful day? And that there is no perfect, that we all make mistakes, and that, you know, to expect the unexpected with motherhood. And so bringing together that the production that shows the realities of what all moms go through helps moms who are struggling with depression and anxiety realize that a lot of times maybe their expectations of themselves aren't reachable, and that's standing in the way of them feeling good about who they are as a mother.
They can hear the characters in the play talking about something and say, oh, that's something I get uptight about. That's not something I laugh about. Now everybody's laughing about that.
Right.
Maybe I better recalibrate.
Right.
What I should get, you know, honked off about. You know, there's another rare disorder, postpartum psychosis. And it's what Andrea Yates suffered from in 2001 when she killed her children in Texas. Tell us what the distinction is in those, that we're not necessarily talking about postpartum psychosis.
Right. Postpartum psychosis, where when you talk about the incidence rate for depression and anxiety being that 1 in 10, sometimes right. 1 in 5 even, that's not talking psychosis. Psychosis is very rare. And the important distinction is that it's a rare disorder where woman is broken from reality. And we have many women who are concerned that, especially if they have anxiety or obsessive compulsive symptoms, that they think, well, what if I'm going to turn psychotic? And it doesn't work like that. They're very different disorders. It's a rare disorder, comes on quickly, usually within the first week. And it is absolutely a medical emergency because of the risk of both self-harm and harm to the family. But
it's not depression.
No. It's a very different disorder. And women who are experiencing depression, anxiety, OCD symptoms aren't at an increased risk for psychosis. So it's a different distinction. They usually feel like they are. I'm going crazy. What if I go crazy? They'll call on the support line and say,
but if you're actually thinking that, you're probably not.
Exactly. And that's usually what we say is, well, if you're worried about it, that's a good sign. You know, what if I'm psychotic? Well, the psychotic woman's not saying, what if I'm psychotic?
So much more common, you said it can be as much as 1 in 5, is the depression. Tell people what they should be looking for. I guess, you know, Patty, you went through it once with your first child. With your second one, did it all of a sudden click? You're like, oh, here it comes again. I'm feeling that way again.
No, actually, that's one of the things that I think is part of, for me at least, part of this disorder is that it's kind of hard for you to see it about yourself. I remember after my second son, you know, during the pregnancy, trying to do everything I could to be ready. And afterwards, you know, at my 6-week checkup, asking my doctor, okay, what should I be looking for? Because I've been through this before. And you would think that it would be glaringly obvious, and maybe to some people it is, but to me, it's like you can't see it about yourself. You don't see how abnormal you're living until you get help. And then you realize, oh, this isn't normal. This isn't just that, you know, I can't deal with life, or I'm a bad mom, or I you know, it's my problem. This is something that I was dealing with. So for me, no. Both times it didn't hit me in the face that something was wrong. I kind of had to hear it from other people until I finally reached out and got help.
So, Tanya, what are some of the symptoms that people should look for, the most common?
Well, a lot of times we hear something's just not right. I can't put my finger on it. So sometimes it is very, you know, very obscure, but feeling guilty, not crying, and you're not quite sure why, having trouble sleeping, baby's asleep, the house is quiet.
Well, darn it, I should be asleep too.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Mine's going a million miles an hour. That's the very common. Feeling uptight and worried a lot. Women typically have a kind of an anxious depression. So there's not always the lethargy that you think of. Sometimes, certainly there is. But being worried and feeling guilty, the guilt and just not quite sure that you're feeling good about things, or feeling, blaming everything, a lot of self-blame, or irritability, frustration, and again, just not feeling like yourself.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air. We've just got about a minute left, but you're a stay-home dad.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, that I can certainly identify as a stay-at-home dad. Can't claim to have postpartum depression, though. I find it certainly do have a lot of sympathy symptoms with my wife, but my main point was I just can really relate to not being able to do anything right.
That's called being a parent in general, doesn't it feel
right.
Like that sometimes?
Yeah. Yeah, but being a stay-at-home dad and the challenge of organizing a home, I was particularly taken with the story about a husband trying to organize things to make it easier, and my wife does that for me. She's a kind of coordinator where she works, and she's really good at it, and it doesn't really help. Those aren't the issues.
Well, thank you for calling, Jerome.
You bet.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And hang in there. Mother's Day is on Sunday. Don't forget. And if you want to learn more about postpartum depression and how to cope with it, you can contact Perinatal Outreach and Encouragement for Moms. We'll have a link for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also want to remind you that the Momologues will be showing this week. It's a it'll be a dramatic reading of a very popular play that came out of Boston. You can learn more about that by going to our website as well. It'll be at the King Arts Complex, in case you're wondering, and it's showing on it Friday and Saturday night, and yes, I am playing a role in that play. It's Maria, and Maria's a control freak, so you'll just have to come and see what I mean and watch the play yourself. I want to thank my guests, Tanya Fullwilder, co-founder and executive director of Poem. Thanks for joining us, Tanya.
Thank you, Anne.
And also Patty O'Brien. She was good enough to share her story about how she sought help from Poem. Thank you very much, Patty, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for listening. That's all the time we have today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Horizon Science and Noble Academies, providing college prep curriculum focusing on science and math. Information about Horizon and Noble Academies college acceptance rates is at horizoncolumbus.org.